Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, July 21st, 2012. I'm Harley Schlanger. I will be your host. On the program today, we're going to take a full overview of the present strategic crisis. By the end of this program, I'm sure you will reach the same conclusion that Lyndon LaRouche has. That is, that if Obama is not removed from the presidency before the Democratic Party convention in early September, there is no guarantee that the human race will survive in a recognizable form. Now, the potential to remove him has grown enormously due to the decision some leading bankers in the United Kingdom reached after the last disastrous European Union Heads of State Summit at the end of June. This grouping includes very prominent bankers, political figures, people like Peter Hambros of Hambros Bank, Sir Nigel Lawson, who was the former Chancellor of the Exchequer under Maggie Thatcher, as well as the Financial Times, which is the newspaper of the City of London. This grouping concluded that Lyndon LaRouche has been right, that the present policy of massive bailouts, combined with killer austerity, combined with the threats of World War III against Russia, represents a deadly threat to humanity, including to them. Though this is a grouping that had previously opposed LaRouche's insistence on a return to Glass-Steagall regulations, they reversed themselves, and they have begun an organizing drive for it as a joint proposition for the United Kingdom and for the United States. At the same time, the true criminal nature of the City of London Wall Street financial paradigm has become clear when the story broke of the bank's rigging of the LIBOR, which sets interest rates for most financial paper, and with the case of Hong Kong Shanghai Bank Corporation, the notorious bank identified in 1978 in the book put out by LaRouche called Dope Incorporated as at the center of international drug running for over 100 years at that time. The story is now out of continued international drug money laundering by Hong Kong, Shanghai, and in fact, the systemic nature of drug money laundering in the financial system as a whole. Now, these two exposures demonstrate that the system itself is rotten. Further, what's come out is the Treasury Secretary, Timothy Geithner, has been at the center of a cover-up of this, which means he's facilitated it. And his boss, President Obama, has been protecting this corrupt system. As congressional hearings and legal cases and some honest journalism have begun to flesh out the scope of these crimes, the other faction in London, which will never accept Glass-Steagall, has struck, using terrorism against Syria and against Russia, and a terrorist attack on Israelis on a bus in Bulgaria, which Netanyahu blamed on Iran, to put World War III back on the front burner. But joining us today on the program to discuss this extraordinary swarm of crises, and you can't really describe it in any other term but a swarm, as well as the potential this gives us to end the imperial system, joining us to discuss this today is Dennis Small, who's a senior editor of the Executive Intelligence Review with special purview over Ibero America, but that extends as well now into Portugal and Spain. Dennis, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Harley. I'm glad to be on the show.
Now, I want to begin by throwing you a bit of an interesting approach to this, but I think one of the most important things we need to do is not merely give the details, although those are important, but to put on the plate of the listeners their responsibility for acting, because we are at a unique moment in history. So with this coming week in particular being a crucial week, if we're going to get Obama out before World War III is ignited, I would say that many of our listeners are quite skeptical. They don't believe that an abrupt change for the good is possible. I want you to begin by telling them why they are wrong so they can figure out what they need to do during the course of the program.
Yeah, fair enough. let me begin that point by just reporting to people Lyndon LaRouche's update on the situation and his organizing perspective as discussed just an hour or two ago in meeting with some of the membership of the organization. And what he laid out is that the next 2 weeks are absolutely decisive. We have to achieve this by the time of the Democratic Party convention, which is early September, so that gives you about 5 or 6 weeks there. However, Congress is in session for the next 2 weeks. And what we are going to do is we are going to ignite a storm in the Congress of the United States to force the issue that people have got to act now. People have to act now to dump Geithner, to get Obama out. Do this week and next. We're going to have a full-scale deployment of our forces in Washington to lay out very straightforwardly to people who are actually thinking in a way that they're not very much accustomed to. In fact, I think it's probably fair to say that a lot of people in Congress aren't accustomed to thinking at all.
But Dennis, isn't this one of the key points, that the one of the reasons we actually have a chance now is that the full weight of these crises are hitting, and Lynn's credibility has never been greater?
Yeah, this comes from telling the truth remorselessly, continuously, despite the immediate short-term responses from people. The issue to be laid out before people in Congress and before the nation and before the listeners of this program is the consequences of acting in the way LaRouche is saying, which is that we can, in fact, reverse this situation, and we'll discuss how that's possible, and the consequences of not acting. And this is now a short-term question. This is now a 2 to 3 week type of cycle. We're in a situation where this can be done, and it has to be done. What's actually important for people to think about, and you know, I was mulling over the same issue you just raised, which is a lot of people say, yeah, sure, we should do that. But come on, that's not doable. It's not doable that fast. Eventually, maybe, you know, give us 10, 20 years.
Well,
which of course we don't
worse,
have. Which of course
even
we
worse,
have.
Dennis, the usual response is, but they have too much power. They always end up on top.
Yeah. The well, this time they're not going to be on top. They're going to be, in many cases, politically 6 feet under. Politically. And in some cases, perhaps a little more specific than that. But the point is, look back. Just for the moment, take a step back and look at what's happened over the last 2 months. Harley just gave people a bird's-eye view of the developments, but think back for a moment of where we were 2 months ago. Would you honestly have expected that the LIBOR crisis would have blown up and proven that approximately $800, $900 trillion in financial instruments were based on an absolute fabricated criminal lie? Would you have thought 2 months ago that you'd have a situation where an important faction of the inner elite of the British Empire around the Rothschilds and the Financial Times would come out for Glass-Steagall along the lines of FDR? But that, in fact, has happened, and everyone knows that that's LaRouche. Would you have thought, as LaRouche clearly did 2 months ago, that the Eurozone would completely melt and disintegrate, would be dysfunctional and in the process of decomposing entirely? And would you have thought 2 months ago that there would be a Senate hearing where what LaRouche has said since 1978 on Hongxiang Banking Corporation, HSBC, as the central bank of the drug trade, that this would be the subject which was being discussed in the corridors of the Congress, and this most august institution of the British Empire was at the point of being vaporized? Probably not. Honestly, if you're speaking honestly to yourself now, I wouldn't have expected that. Well, the same process which unleashed those rapid changes is exactly the same process, with LaRouche's role at the center of it, which is capable of producing the kind of changes that are required and can be done over the next 2, 3, 4 week period. We're in a moment where the entire financial system is completely disintegrating. And that's what the LIBOR crisis and the Hongshan crisis means. We'll get into those details as needed.
Well,
the entire crisis is imploding entirely. And what that means is that it is palpable to people, palpable, that unless this thing has changed, you are going to have no food in the United States, people starving. You're going to have massive drugs all over the place, even more than now exists. You're going to have cities which grind down to zero economic activity with no employees, with everybody laid off, and you're going to have a situation which is politically unmanageable with absolute chaos and, very likely as well, the nuts faction unleashing war as they're trying to do using Syria as a trigger. So the issue facing Congress, and we will help them face this issue this week and next with heavy deployments Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday of each week, is what are the consequences of not acting now and what can be done if you decide to act along with LaRouche. And that's the kind of issue that can and will shape the situation into the kind of rapid changes that we've also seen, as I said, over this last couple of month period.
Now, what I'd like to do is pull some of these threads together, because when people actually see that it is a coherent process and it's something which they can conceptualize, then it becomes more clear to them that there is, that we can have, you could imagine the outcome that we're discussing, namely the demise of Obama and his team. So I'd like to begin with what I think is the crucial development. This is something that Helga Zepp-LaRouche has been stressing, which is the ongoing complete failure of the bankers and technocrats of the European Union to deal with the what they call the debt crisis or the banking crisis or the sovereign crisis, but that especially after the June 27th-28th meeting or 28th-29th meeting, it obviously was clear that there was no solution. Now, since that time, just today we saw something, I know you've been watching this closely, the situation in Spain. So it's no longer just Greece. Just give people a thumbnail sketch of how out of control the situation is.
Well, you know, I'm constantly reminded of what Lyndon LaRouche has joked about for not years but decades, that you have a certain kind of situation that develops when all of a sudden, seemingly all of a sudden, the way things used to work produce opposite results. He would describe this as you'd be driving along in your car and you jam on the brakes, and instead of stopping, the car would veer to the left. You'd hit the accelerator and the car would grind to a halt. That's the kind of thing that's going on in Europe at this point. Every single thing that they've done, supposedly to address and deal with the crisis, has in fact made it worse. And that's because the premises on which they're dealing with this thing, which is on the one hand bone-crunching austerity to cut back all spending, all employment, and on the other hand massive hyperinflation to bail out the banks over and over and over again, is in fact killing the very economic process which they themselves depend on. I mean, look at the situation of Spain. You mentioned that, so we can start
yeah,
there.
It's a good place to start.
What happened, Spain was the big topic of discussion at the 28th, 29th of June European summit meeting. Two things happened there that were heralded as two big achievements. First of all, Angela Merkel, the Chancellor of Germany, was pressured and blackmailed and cajoled into finally agreeing to the establishment of the European Stabilization Mechanism, the ESM, which would basically bail out all of the banks of Europe at the expense of the countries paying into that, which primarily means Germany. In other words, it would be German citizens that would end up paying out, just like occurred with the hyperinflationary bailouts here with Geithner, that finally Angela Merkel had agreed to this thing, and that was viewed as a great accomplishment by the British and the City of London, and they would now proceed. Second great accomplishment is that Spain, which was requesting an 100 billion euro bailout of its banks, was promised that they would get the money, but without conditionalities. In other words, unlike Greece, Spain would not have to impose any conditionalities. Well, let's look at those two great achievements. We're less than a month later. On the subject of the European Stabilization Mechanism, it doesn't exist. And in fact, the Constitutional Court in Germany, in Karlsruhe, is considering a temporary restraining order, which has been presented as a suit before the court, and has announced that they're not going to make any decision on this thing until the early part of September, even deciding whether or not to grant the temporary restraining order. So the urgent push to get the ESM established right now, that was much trumpeted. It hasn't happened, and there are major challenges going on across the board, not only in Germany, incidentally, but Austria as well, and some interesting things in other countries as well. The second supposed great achievement, breakthrough, that was achieved was Spain, that was supposed to get this money without conditionalities. Except the day that they got the first tranche of 30 billion euros, it turned out that the night before, they had signed a memorandum of understanding with the Troika. Now, the Troika, for those who don't know, is the IMF, the European Central Bank, and the European Union. You mention the word Troika in Greece, and people start to pull out their baseball bats, because that's who they'd like to get rid of really quick.
Well, and it should be, again, emphasized. Rajoy had said, the Prime Minister of Spain said, under no circumstances would he accept the memorandum of understanding.
Right. And in fact, in the 6 or 7 months he's been in office, because he just came in December, he had promised no taxes, and he's had to raise taxes 4 times. This is one of those kinds of situations. But this memorandum of understanding actually had 32 clauses with very specific conditionalities that Spain was going to have to adopt in order to get the money. Exactly what they said would never happen. And besides all of the cutbacks in austerity, there's 2 specific points of this memorandum of understanding that are important to understand qualitatively. In other words, that point to where this thing is heading. Number one, they had to agree that in any refinancing of banks, that those banks would have to take write-downs or haircuts on the bonds held by the small retail holders of bonds and stocks in their banks. In other words, banks in Spain had suckered a bunch of customers of their own to buy 67 billion euros of so-called preferred stock and junior bonds. And the memorandum of understanding, as dictated by the Troika, said those are the people who have to take the hit to make sure that the speculative bankers get off scot-free. And this has been described, rightly so, as an anti-Glass-Steagall. In other words, it does everything that Glass-Steagall says you should do, which is, Glass-Steagall says, wipe out speculation, favor honest commercial lending, and this does the exact opposite. And this was written into the Memorandum of Understanding, number one. Number two, the Bank of Spain formally handed over sovereignty of all financial and banking matters in Spain to the European Central Bank and to the European Union. Spain is now formally no longer a sovereign country in terms of its own finances. And these are two aspects.
This is causing a big reaction from the population.
Yeah, there's a huge reaction because they don't like what's happening to them, but they don't understand what's going on either. I mean, this is the kind of problem that we face in general. People know the pain. They're feeling excruciating pain, but they don't know where it's coming from. Therefore, they have no way of acting to actually get rid of the pain unless we provide that leadership both in the United States and internationally.
Now, Dennis, I think the most relevant point of all of this description in Spain is that even if they absolutely adhere completely to this memorandum of understanding and do exactly what they're told, they're still going to end up owing more debt and shut down more of their physical economy. In other words, everything they're doing is exactly what's caused the crisis in the first place.
For the very simple reason that in the world economy at this point, and Spain is a part of the world economy, you have 2 different processes going on at the same time, and you've got to look at both. One is the monetary or the financial and the speculative process and those financial assets, and the other is the actual physical economy of the goods and services that people need to survive, the actual productivity of labor. And if you mix those 2 things up, either because you're conceptually mixed up or because you had the misfortune of studying economics at any university in the United States, that will definitely confuse you on this. If you somehow jumble these 2 things together, you're going to screw absolutely everything up, because the more you try to save the speculative bubble, if your starting point, as it was with Bush and as it is with Obama, is first save the bubble, second, save the bubble, third, save the bubble, and then, of course, fourth, save my own ass, That policy is going to destroy the physical economy, and it's happening in the United States, it's happening in Spain, it's happening globally. That process has now hit a brick wall for everyone to clearly see, which is why we have the kind of political opportunity that we do.
Well, that's the point, the reason we've discussed this situation with Spain is to make clear that there are some people in Britain who may not be good people, but they're not stupid. The empire hasn't survived for thousands of years because there's no cleverness. There are some people who are clever. They looked at this and they said, this is never going to work. And I presume that's where we're seeing this motion to reverse the trend of the last 45 years and go back with Glass-Steagall.
Yeah, the move around the Glass-Steagall question on the British side is really a lesson in what makes history work. Because you see the most seemingly unlikely of developments. If you had simply linearly projected forward what was going on 2 months ago, you would never have reached the situation we're in today. That itself is proof that history and processes don't work in a linear fashion. And not only do you have Financial Times, Hambros, and Rothschilds, as you mentioned, pushing for a Glass-Steagall approach, and it is the FDR Glass-Steagall approach, meaning that this message had the name of Lyndon LaRouche written all over it. Because
Dennis, we should add, coming from people who have spent years trying to destroy Lyndon LaRouche.
Sure, and thrown him in jail, and there have been attempted assassinations, and so on and so forth. But they've realized that, in fact, if the world is to survive under these circumstances, this kind of change is going to be needed. Now, it should be emphasized that what actually led to this immediate rapid change that occurred was not an economic development as such, but it was the fact that the Russian high command and the Russian government, in combination with the Joint Chiefs of Staff and a few other military people in the United States, absolutely put their foot down against the intended plan coming from the British Empire to use a nuclear war or a threat of a nuclear war to force a backdown from the Russians and the Chinese and others, and to impose the kind of hyperinflationary bailout scheme that the British were demanding. That did not work. It did not work from the period of November into the early spring. It was stopped cold, dead to rights, and therefore there had to be a regrouping. And the regrouping from one grouping, was, this is not going to work. We're going to have to do this thing by going in the direction of Glass-Steagall. It's what produced this kind of change that we're seeing at this point. I do want to underscore that just this last week, there was another major indication of what's on the mind of this group in Britain, where they named a 10-person committee in Britain composed of 5 people from the House of Lords, 5 from the House of Commons, to discuss total financial reorganization. And among those 10 people, 3 are very prominent proponents of Glass-Steagall, and the most prominent of all is the person you mentioned in your opener, Lord Nigel Lawson, whose name is synonymous with Glass-Steagall in Great Britain because he's been pushing it for quite some time now. So these type of developments are very specifically vectored towards the United States and to Lyndon LaRouche and from the people who are prepared to wake up enough to act under LaRouche's leadership at this point. There is a very narrow path to get out of this. It's a very narrow path. But it does exist, and it means moving on it rapidly over this immediate period ahead.
And that's where we're going to go in the next 30 minutes. You're listening to The LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, July 21st, 2012, and we're talking with Dennis Small, a senior editor from the Executive Intelligence Review. And we're talking not just about briefing points or new facts that you might want to use to impress your friends. We're talking about something that, because of the processes which determine history, has fallen into our lap, so to speak. It's not that Lyndon LaRouche hasn't been working on this for 40 years and our organization hasn't been involved in it, but when the opportunity came, when this grouping in Britain said, we're going with Glass-Steagall, it was immediately seen by Lynn as a potential to move to finish off the presidency of Barack Obama, who's been an agent of these people from the beginning. Now, this is where it gets interesting, because when this first came down, and Lynn immediately said, okay, they're sending a message to me, now we've got to go and escalate. There were many, many people who had no idea what he was talking about or how it could work. And then we've seen in the last 2 weeks in particular, with the maturation or development, you might say, of the LIBOR case and the HSBC case, new weapons being given to us in this. And Dennis, I'd like you to take up the story from there. What LIBOR represents as part of this potential for change, and then also HSBC.
Yeah, let me make a couple of points about this. I mean, the LIBOR rate, it's what LIBOR stands for, supposedly, is London Interbank Offered Rate. And it was set up originally in the mid-80s on the basis of a complete mafia hoax. What they did, and I'll explain this mafia angle on it because I think that's really the best way to understand this. What they did is that with the creation of the Euro-dollar market in the city of London, which occurred after the oil hoax and after U.S. sovereign control over the dollar had been wiped out with the end of the Bretton Woods system in 1971, the dollar, so-called, or the Euro-dollar, was taken over. It stopped being our currency, and it became rather the currency of this international imperial oligarchical force. Now, what happened is what used to be the prime rate and fixed interest rate policies which governed lending in all areas was replaced with this idea of a floating interest rate, the London Interbank Offered Rate. And it was set supposedly by banks who had some mysterious deep knowledge of what the market between the banks, the rate at which they lent each other money, what that was. And then all the interest rates in the world were set based on that LIBOR rate plus a markup of however much. So you have a floating rate, if you're going to borrow money, you have a floating rate, and then it's marked up by a certain amount. Now, any of you who have ever used a credit card have a good idea of what's that like, because credit cards are based, as you probably know, on floating rates. Okay. Now, what the British did with this thing is the fact that you had a completely unpredictable floating rate that then was marked up by a certain amount made it necessary for municipalities, for cities, for states, for anybody who wanted to have some sort of a predictable rate at which they would be paying, that they would then be forced to go back to the same people who created the LIBOR to buy what was called and is called an interest rate swap. And what that means is you pay the same bank that set up this whole operation in the first place to give you a fixed rate in exchange for your paying them a fee for this derivative instrument that you're buying. So you are forced by these people, by their fabrication of this LIBOR, to then go to them to buy derivative instruments, and you're then stuck, when they manipulate the LIBOR rate going down, you're stuck paying through the nose millions and millions and billions and then trillions of dollars to these guys who are manipulating the whole rate.
And Dennis, let me make one additional point on this. Because of the getting rid of Glass-Steagall, you now have a situation where the people who were selling you this financial paper, the so-called risk insurance, knew in advance where the rates were going to go because they're part of the same bank. The bank that sets the rates and the swindlers who sell the insurance know in advance where it's going to go, whereas you don't, and they're not going to tell you.
It's exactly like the mafia. It's the mafia guys who throw a brick through your storefront window late one night and show up the next morning to offer you protection. That's why I think LIBOR should actually stand for the London Interbank Offer You Can't Refuse. Because that's how this thing actually works. And this process of rigging a floating rate system that you then have got to be looted for to try to create some sort of stability is exactly what happened on the international currency markets as well back in 1971 when the Bretton Woods system was destroyed and instead what was ushered in was the floating rate system to replace a fixed rate system. But that's a whole other discussion.
But you had said earlier that we're talking about $800 to $900 trillion in instruments. And I think it's important for the listeners to realize that every bit of financial paper, the so-called financial innovation market that Greenspan praised, that we're supposed to be protecting because of its great ingenuity to allow for financing and so on. There are two aspects to it. One is there's no financing that's going on with this because it's all frozen and it's all going into keeping the bubble up on the first place. But secondly, everything, whether it's mortgages, whether it's college loans, credit cards, everything was set around this LIBOR, this rate, which means that literally they've not only created 800 to 900 trillion, but they've tied it all up so that they're buying and selling the same worthless paper, and they're making money while everyone else is losing.
Yeah, exactly. Every single thing, every kind of interest rate instrument in the financial system is based on this. And then on top of that, you have the derivatives, like interest rate swaps, which were set up, which is why you have 800 to 900 trillion total. It's interesting that actually of all the different derivatives categories, interest rate swaps is the single largest one. So this thing was a very carefully planned out fraud that was perpetrated. It was not carried out with the acquiescence and the regulators looking in the other direction. The regulators are part of the game. Tim Geithner knew about this not because it happened across his desk that somebody was doing something naughty. The role of the Federal Reserve, the people on the Federal Reserve, as we have said many times, the Federal Reserve is not a national bank. We used to have a national bank in this country, right? As was set up originally by Hamilton and then Biddle and what was done under Lincoln and so on and so forth. The Federal Reserve is actually a private bank run by the private banks of Wall Street in particular. And the people on the board of the New York Federal Reserve are exactly the people who are benefiting from this whole swindle operation. This is really a case of the fox guarding the chicken coop. And Geithner not only knew about it, but he was party to the crimes throughout. And therefore, this ridiculous game that's going on of, oh gosh, I really didn't know. Oh, I'm so sorry that people did some bad, naughty things. This game has got to stop. These people were in charge. They were doing it. It's Geithner. It's also Bernanke, and it's absolutely Obama. And I'm sure there's some people back from the Bush era that we can also find who are responsible as well.
Dennis, I think one of the smoking guns on this is this memo that Geithner sent out, which he said, which actually his apologist said make him a hero because it showed that he was trying to do something. One of the phrases in it is that he wanted to eliminate incentives to misrepresent. Now, as a regulator, the way you eliminate incentives to misrepresent is you jail the bastards who are misrepresenting and seize their gains. Geithner did nothing. Now, I think the other point that we've made on this is that this is not just a financial scandal, but it's something which is killing people. And this came up in a number of cities, but one I'd like to highlight, and people can go to our website, thelaruchepact.com, to get this story. It'll be out, I think, in the next day or so, is that we went before the Detroit City Council, and where they're imposing brutal austerity. They're shutting down police and fire departments, branches. They're closing hospitals. They're closing schools. The ability of the police and fire departments to respond to emergencies has been drastically reduced. Lives are already being lost, and because they have to pay these swaps and pay these interest rate instruments first before they pay for the social services they're supposed to provide. And our candidate for Congress in that district, Bill Roberts, in the 11th District of Michigan, went before the city council and said, you shouldn't be discussing austerity to pay back the banks. We should be putting the bankers who did this to the city in jail. And there was a very strong response on the council because people know it. They're sitting there thinking they have no option but to make killer cuts. And now, because of this process that we've been describing, it now becomes clear to them that for them to do their job and represent their constituents, there's a target. It's these bankers. And Glass-Steagall is the instrument they can use. And this affects 75% of the city, county, and state governments in the United States. So every one of our listeners should take what they've just heard on this mafia-style killer operation that Dennis described and go to your city council, go to your local representatives and tell them, we have 2 weeks to act on this to get Geithner and Obama out. And I just wanted to interject that there before we go on, because I think this is what we mean when we say we've been handed an opportunity to win this fight.
Yeah, absolutely, because it is exactly what should be happening all around the country over this next two-week period. As our forces concentrate on Washington, D.C., and talking to Congress here, LaRouche today also said we have to be doing the same thing around the country in exactly the way Harley was just describing. Because, you see, there's an underlying question here, and let me just take a moment to step back before we proceed on to what I know are the other stories we want to cover, because they're totally related, the Hongshan question and so on. But the problem here is that people, including city residents and city councils and so on and so forth, get caught up in the idea that somehow, well, that's the way the system works and that's the way it is, and you just have to stop the excesses. There's sort of a, well, boys will be boys type of attitude on this thing, and you just need a good regulator to somehow stop the worst from happening. But that's wrong. That's wrong. It is not a question of the system just has to be stopped in its worst excesses. The problem is that the very nature of the monetary or the financial system as it's now set up, the kind of monetarist system which has been put in place, equates value with money. There is no other systematic equation that's made. And therefore, if value is money, anything you do to make money, so long as it's not blatantly illegal, so long the argument goes, well, that's the way it's got to be. But that there's no basis in economics for establishing any moral judgment as to what has value or not. And therefore, if that's your starting point, then you are going to end up basically buying into the system completely. The point is, we not only need Glass-Steagall to completely separate out speculation from actual productive commercial banking, we then have to establish something which is called a credit system. We actually have to have a system which defines value not in terms of monetary figures, but in terms of the actual usefulness of the economic activity to develop the productive powers of labor, to improve the welfare of the present and future generations, the general welfare of the nation as a whole. That's how this nation was founded. That's what a credit system is. And unless you are willing and prepared to completely, thoroughgoingly replace the current system with a credit system, you're going to get caught up in the arguments that end up with saying, well, boys will be boys. We've got to get in Glass-Steagall, number one. Number two, we have to have a credit system. And number three, we have to immediately implement this around NWAPA and related high technology projects, which the LaRouche movement has identified in great detail. And I think this underlying question is crucial. When you go to your city council, and you should be doing it this week and next, when you raise these issues, you've got to present this thoroughgoing picture on this thing, because you cannot eliminate corruption and wrongdoing within a criminal system. The system itself has got to be replaced.
And you must not go as a victim saying, someone has to recognize my victimization, because the people we're dealing with know you're victims. They set up the system precisely to victimize you. And the American people, for all our history, for all that we know that we can do and all the good things this nation has done, the current boomer generation and the younger generations are victims. They see themselves as victims, and, well, what can you do? That's the way the game is rigged. Well, it's rigged that way because people haven't done anything about it, because you've given up your right as a sovereign citizen. And again, this is an opportunity for the American people to take back their sovereignty and to really win back their dignity, which I think is a crucial factor if we're going to save the nation and save humanity.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, the latest developments which have come up, which Harley had mentioned before, is the story around HSBC, the Hong Kong Banking Corporation, which back in 1978, which was 34 years ago in the first edition of Dope Incorporated that the LaRouche movement put out, we described or defined as, quote, the Central Bank for Dope Incorporated. And I'm reading from page 93 of the edition of Dope Inc. I have in front of me right here. I'm not sure what year it's from. That's what we said they were. That is what they are. And we got ourselves into a hell of a lot of trouble saying that, but we were right. Now, just this last week, on Tuesday, there was a hearing at the Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations, chaired by Senator Carl Levin, the Democrat of Michigan, and by co-chaired by Dick Coburn, Republican of Oklahoma. They released a 330-page report, which went through in detail HSBC's direct involvement of laundering drug money. Now, I'm going to come to the drug money question in a minute, because it is obviously crucial, because that's another one of these things, which is not sort of, oh, one of these criminal things that just happened. It is the nature of the system. But I want to actually first point to something which is a tremendous vulnerability of this crowd right now. And that is that in those 330 pages, that report documents that HSBC actually financed to the tune of $1 billion a Saudi bank by the name of Al Raji. Now, Al Raji was known and documented and was known at the time to HSBC and was known at the time to the regulators, so-called, of HSBC, which would be Geithner, as one of the leading conduits for the financing of the 9/11 attacks on the United States. What has happened in this last week is that the Saudi interests that are behind and were behind all along the 9/11 attack, along with British intelligence and with complicit people inside the United States, but the crucial Saudi elements, which were run through a guy called Prince Bandar. Prince Bandar has just been named to be the head of Saudi intelligence, meaning that there is a double, triple green light from those sources, the same people who brought you 9/11, to use Bandar and his filthy networks, including HSBC, to unleash holy hell throughout the Middle East in particular, to try to finally get off the ground the thermonuclear world war these guys have been looking for. Guy Bandar is vulnerable. He's got to be stopped. He's a buddy of Geithner's. And this is one of the things that was actually pointed out in this this HSBC report that was issued by the Senate committee.
And this takes on even added meaning, given the Saudi role in running the operations, probably in conjunction with a section of Israeli intelligence that we used this last week to take out the command structure of the Syrian government.
Yeah, this was a highly professional hit that was carried out, and the message was very clear. We don't care if you try to stop us through legal measures, if you try to stop us through diplomacy, if the Russians have again, along with the Chinese, thrown a total roadblock into a repeat of the Libya operation in Syria. These guys are saying, we don't care, we're going to blow this thing sky high. And that was the message they were sending. And most likely it came from Israeli or other related circles, British, Saudi, and so on, who are intent on blowing this thing sky high.
So, Dennis, from what you know then of the HSBC hearing, this is so crucial for people to know that the book Dope Incorporated, which was cited repeatedly as one of the reasons for this network to go after LaRouche, because of the emphasis on the British dope wars going back to the opium wars against China. In fact, it was after the second opium war against China that Hong Kong Shanghai was set up as the official drug bank of the British Empire. But the fact that this is coming out now, again, plays right into this whole question of our ability to use our authority to move people in the Congress to get Obama out now.
I mean, this is one of these developments which has LaRouche was right written all over it. It's exactly like what happened with the Glass-Steagall question coming from the British. If you had told me a couple of years ago that you were going to get this major expose of Hong Shang Bank coming out, I would have been somewhat dubious. But, I mean, that's just the fact of the matter. But that's exactly how these processes work, because to go after Hong Shang as a drug-running bank, there's only one person who has done that, and that is Lyndon LaRouche. And we took all sorts of flack for it. You've probably heard it. Oh, Lyndon LaRouche says the Queen of England runs drugs. Well, here is the bank, which was based originally in Hong Kong. When Hong Kong then went over to the Chinese, they shifted their headquarters to London. For over 100 years, they have been the central bank of the drug trade. That's exactly what we said about it. And incidentally, just parenthetically, a few months back, a bank called Coutts & Company, which is literally the bank of the Queen of England, was fined by the Financial Services Agency or Administration of Britain for laundering money. So yes, I guess it does look like the Queen of England and people around her have been involved in laundering drug money. And now you have a Senate committee in the United States which is investigating this very actively. But part of the story here, Harley, let me just really emphasize this point. It is the drug money laundering. It is the financing of 9/11. But the people who were in charge with oversight are as complicit in the crime, more complicit than the guys who are selling heroin and smack and cocaine and killing kids on the street and shooting people down on the Mexican border. The people, and this was said by the Senate committee, the people in charge of oversight and responsibility of HSBC throughout this period of 2007, 8, and so on, where they were laundering billions of drug dollars, physical drug dollars, carrying dollars back to the United States from Mexico and so on, was the OCC. The OCC is the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency. The Office of the Comptroller of the Currency operates under the Department of the Treasury, the Treasury Department. And the Secretary of the Treasury today is Timothy Geithner. Now, the OCC received reports about some funny things going on, you know, just a couple of billion dollars here and there that nobody could really explain. And over this entire six-year period, guess how many actions they took against HSBC to stop this? Zero. Zero. No action whatsoever. So this is not, I mean, this gives a whole new meaning to the word oversight. Maybe overlook. I mean, the point I'm making is that the system itself, the so-called regulators are complicit in the crime because the nature of the system is criminal. And that's what this HSBC thing points out. Geithner's got to go.
I just want to draw one other point here because I want to come back at the end to this question of what we have to do. But the other point is that this investigation of the drug money laundering goes back to two other ways to the Obama administration. One is Fast and Furious, and the other is the laundering of money by George Soros, the pro-drug speculator George Soros, into the Obama campaign in 2008. That there are leads that are being followed now which show that some of this laundered drug money bought the presence of ineligible voters into the caucuses in 2008 that ended up giving the nomination to Barack Obama.
Yeah, and there's plenty of evidence on this thing. The Fast and Furious is a small piece of it, although it's a very dramatic small piece of it and a very offensive small piece of it, because American agents were killed in this process with weapons trafficked by the department, the ATF, working in the Justice Department. So it's not limited to Geithner. We should certainly throw Holder into the equation on this thing as well. It's exactly the way this whole system functions and what these guys were directly involved in. Soros, of course, is the major financier of every drug legalization campaign that's ever been run internationally, and including those in the United States, and he was one of the main financiers directly and through the groups that he helped set up of the Obama administration. So there's that side of the involvement as well, absolutely. An additional thing, it should be noted that with these revelations on the HSBC coming out from the Senate committee, the Department of Justice under Holder has moved very rapidly to try to reach a settlement with HSBC, which will involve basically a slap on the wrist, a $1 billion fine, and no criminal charges. Now, you know, a $1 billion fine on a trade, the drug trade today is worth somewhere between $800 billion and $1 trillion a year. That's a very small operating cost. HSBC, the Senate committee said this, was in the late 2000s directly laundering up to 70% of all of the money coming from Mexico into the United States. 70% through this one bank. And mind you, HSBC is only the fifth largest bank in Mexico. It's not the largest bank. And let me remind our listeners that 80% of all drugs coming into the United States come through Mexico. So this is not a small amount of money or a small-time operation. This is the real thing. And it's what they pointed their finger at. And it's something that, you know, we've spent 34 years pointing our finger. We're very glad others are finally getting into it. But it's time to do what's necessary to change this entire system. We've got an opportunity. This is the time to move on it.
Well, and that's the point, because what we've been discussing this afternoon is that you've got a whole series of what ordinarily would look like huge scandals. But what you find out is that they're not huge scandals. They're part of the way the system functions. They're part of the reason Obama was put in office, to protect them. And by bringing this out, as we're doing today, as Lyndon LaRouche has been doing, as our forces are going to be doing the next 2 weeks, going to the Congress to discuss these things, we have an explosive situation that can bring this whole system down and put in its place the American system. We're not shooting blanks. We've got an approach that's already worked, and so that's why I opened this program by asking you to address the skepticism that exists or the cynicism in the population, because this is the time to give up your cynicism and to become an American optimist again. Roll up your sleeves and get into the fight, and Dennis, just give people a sense of what's coming up in these again. As we did in the beginning, but the next 2 weeks, why are these so crucial? What can people do?
Well, the next 2 weeks are absolutely decisive, because all the cards are on the table, although there may be some more put up there, but these next 2 weeks, Congress is in session, both the House and the Senate in Washington. We intend to visit them and to have very serious, hard-nosed discussions with them. They are our employees, they are our representatives as citizens, and they have got to act now. We've got to stop Obama, get him out, get Geithner out, get Holder out, and we have to get a new Democratic Party nominee, and the Republican nominee also needs to be replaced. Romney would be a total disaster. This country needs a choice. The reason is that the consequences of either Obama or Romney mean the destruction of this nation and the destruction of the world, and very likely thermonuclear war. That's the now demonstrable consequence, as everybody can see, from the LIBOR scandal, so-called, the Hongsheng Bank scandal, so-called, and everything that's been evolving. If we don't stop this entire system, not just slap a few people on the wrist, but completely change the system, get in Glass-Steagall just the way Roosevelt did, get a credit system set up, and immediately start hiring for productive jobs around NOAPA. If we don't do that, everything is going to disintegrate into a situation that's going to look like the 14th century Dark Ages. I would conclude with taking a step back again. I really think that it's important for people to have a sense of what is happening today. Look at the present, what's happening today, the kinds of situations we've just described from the top, with this panoply of developments. Look at the present as what was the past's future. In other words, look at today from the standpoint of where you were thinking 2 months ago, and look at today as the future of that past. And what was the kind of process that had to be occurring to bring about the kind of dramatic changes which we're already seeing? When you start thinking that way, then conceptualize the present as the future's past. In other words, both as the past future and also the future's past. In other words, look at today as merely the prelude of the future which we can in fact create. And in a very short period of time, over an immediate period ahead, it is doable. If you understand that what is actually shaping history are ideas that are appropriate to solve a crisis of the sort humanity has not faced since at least the new Dark Ages of the 14th
century. This is where it's accurate to say that principles trump party, or principles trump pragmatism or experience, because there's nothing in anybody's experience to put them in this situation and give them knowledge of it. And yet Lyndon LaRouche forecast most of these events And the thing that you just described is, in fact, the process by which Mr. LaRouche's forecasting functions. But he's not a prisoner to experience or to sense perception. And this is, to me, the lesson for the American people, is that we were founded as a result of a very profound philosophical trend in Western civilization, that in particular dated from Nicholas of Cusa and the colonization of America. And this is something that's been lost. So by actually getting into this fight, you can relive an experience of what it means to create a republic. And I think this is something that, for no other reason than actually being able to speak knowledgeably about these processes, people should go to our website, engage in discussions of these issues, and fight like hell to bring Obama down. Dennis, we just have a couple minutes left. If you have a couple of words in summary, go for it.
Yeah, no, I think that it's, we're in a situation where we can win. It's very important to fight for principle, whether you're going to win or lose. But when you do that consistently, as LaRouche has done, and has gotten himself in a hell of a lot of trouble for fighting for principle, including going to jail, and fighting against forces that seemed invincible at certain points, like the drug trade or like the British Empire, if you do that consistently and stand up for that and rally people around that, it has results, and you open up a pathway of possible victory. So it's very important to fight for principle, even if you don't win. It's a lot more fun if you fight for principle and you also do win. And I think we can do that now. So let's get busy. We've got a couple of weeks to do some serious work and stay in touch over that period.
And wouldn't it be exciting to actually have a convention that's not pre-scripted down to the last second, where there's actually maybe 30 ballots to choose a presidential candidate and the choice is based on a fight over ideas and policies? I think that's something that would be, in itself, the kind of breath of fresh air that would create new life in this country.
Yeah, and that would be a whole lot better than 99% of everything else you see on television these days, that's for sure.
Yeah. Dennis, thanks very much for joining us today, and I think it should be clear to our listeners, as I said at the beginning, that they can now see how this has occurred, what's involved in it. Now the question is your activity. Be on our website. There are phone numbers there you can call. You can send emails. Get involved in the campaigns. We have two election campaigns coming up in 2 weeks, Bill Roberts in Michigan and Dave Christie in Seattle. We also have Rachel Brown running in Massachusetts again. And, of course, Keisha Rogers won her primary and is going to be on the ballot in November in Texas. So there's ample opportunity to get engaged. Do that. Thanks for joining us today. This has been the LaRouche Show, and we'll be back next Saturday at 3 p.m.